Is It Rolling Bob?
Talking Dylan.
He's your host, Lucas Hare.
He's your host, Kerry Shale.
But on the digital Bob phone from New York, he's our guest, wine and food critic, Eric Asimov.
The air is getting hotter. There's a rumbling in the skies. I've been wading through the high muddy water with the heat rising in my eyes. Every day your memory grows dimmer. It doesn't haunt me like it did before. I've been walking through the middle of nowhere, trying to get to heaven before they close the door. When I was in Missouri, they would not let me be. I had to leave there in a hurry. I only saw what they let me see. You broke a heart that loved you. Now you can seal up the book, not write anymore. I've been walking that lonesome valley, trying to get to heaven before they close the door.
I love that. You know, I've never really noticed seal up the book before. That's an interesting turn of phrase. Anyway, Eric, welcome. And why did you choose that?
It's really hard to pick out a phase of Dylan. You know, I'm 64 years old, and he's been meaningful to me my whole conscious life, it seems. And, you know, I could have picked out something from my teenage years when, you know, he was piercing the hypocrisy and it's easy to see without looking too far. Not much is really sacred. Mm. And, you know, college years, it seemed that every album had something to say about heartbreak and relationships that weren't going anywhere for me. Then in my 30s, the religious songs were actually quite meaningful. But I thought, you know, now what I listen to more than anything are the later Dylan albums, or at least a few of them. And I decided on this song because I just love the kind of melancholy, the moodiness of it, the world weariness, and also just the way everything is located geographically. It's almost kind of a travelogue around America and dealing with heartbreak. It's a beautiful song.
I noticed you broke a heart that loves you for the first time when you said those lyrics. I thought, wow, that's a really incisive, accusatory line, which I don't think I'd heard before.
Yeah, and you know, who broke the heart? When did it happen? We don't know, but it looks like he's just trying to put it behind him. And you know, there's so much in this song that seems to sort of carry themes through the decades. If you listen to, if you see her say hello, she thinks that I've forgotten her. Don't tell her it isn't so. Or most of the time, you know, it's he's always trying to forget somebody and it's not quite working.
Yeah, that's a pretty good point.
Is Time Out of Mind one of your big go-tos in the later album series?
I think the songs on it, the songs that I like, are great. With all of the albums, there are songs that invariably I just have to skip. And Time Out of Mind is one of those albums where my favorite song is from Telltale Signs, the original version of Can't Wait.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, I totally agree.
Which I think is so brilliant. I'm not one of those people that's, you know, always castigating Bob on the choices that he made. Yeah, I don't really feel like I have that. He knows his reasons. He knows why he's doing things. But on that song, it's like, why didn't you do this? But you know, it's so raw and so emotional and so brilliant before, you know, so many of the songs get caught up in that morass of Daniel Lanois. But yeah, this album just set everything going again.
I love the lyrics in that version of Can't Wait. The I've been drinking forbidden juices. I've been living on lame excuses. I mean, that's what a loss that was to not have.
I know.
Funny because just this morning I was listening to Spotify and I was listening to Telltale Signs, and I found the alternative version number 2. That's what they call it, which is one of the ones that they added, you know, fairly recently that came from the big box set.
The Pink Floyd version.
The version of Can't Wait, which is it's basically organ driven. There's this organ bass and it runs 7.5 minutes.
So it sounds like something out of a late 70s Pink Floyd, I think.
Do you know the one I mean? Mm. And I just love it. I love it. It sounds like Daniel Lanois maybe left the room or something. You know, they're it's not tight. They're just sort of working out. I like it, again, more than the one on the album. The album's, it's really, to be honest, one that's, I kind of grip my teeth through some of the tracks. And actually, Trying to Get to Heaven, I have to say, has never been one of my big faves. But, you know, this is why we're talking. I mean, why that one in particular, Erica? I mean, I'm wondering, you know, is it lyrically the idea of Trying to Get to Heaven? Is there something about the lyrics or just the feel of it?
There's both. One of the things with Dylan, one of the challenging things for me is divorcing the words from the music. I tried to read this a few times to my wife, and she kept catching me on trying to reproduce the singing cadence that Bob was using, which, you know, is just impossible. But it's the mood of it. It's the atmosphere. And I'm really drawn to the atmospheres that he creates, or atmospheric in anything, in film, in literature. And I think this is just one of his most atmospheric songs. I'm not that interested in plot as I am in atmosphere. So, you know, I kind of I lose the thread with Lily Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts, or those long narrative songs. But this I just love.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I am quite plot driven, I think, more and more. Not in Dylan songs. I'm absolutely with you as far as atmosphere, but I happened to see, I saw Licorice Pizza the other day, the film, which has got the best reviews of the year.
Really awesome.
And it's got no plot. And I just couldn't, I enjoyed the first hour. And then I thought, I'm sorry, it's just like, it's a bunch of guest cameos. I know this is not Bob Dylan, obviously, but I thought, what's wrong with you? Why are you so plot-focused? You should be more, you know, your mind should be more expansive. And it is with Dylan, because with Dylan, I genuinely don't care.
And, you know, with this song, you can feel the humidity rising, the heat, the fog. It's almost misty. And it's so archaic as well, you know, whether it's riding in a buggy with Miss Mary Jane or going down to the parlor. And, you know, that's something that's just, it seems characteristic of Dylan. You can't quite place it in time, but because of the language that he uses, it just stretches back into history.
Had you, Eric, when that album came out, had you, like many people, not all people, but had you, like many people, slightly given up on him in that it was his first album of new songs in a while? It's 25 years ago now, but there was a dry patch before that album came out.
Yes. You know, I sort of had, but things kept coming out that kept my interest, whether it had been Biograph or the first bootleg LPs. And I was a big fan of the two acoustic albums he did. I really enjoyed those albums. I loved his guitar playing, which I think people are kind of roundly criticized and often rightly so. But in those albums, it's fantastic. And just the revisiting these old folk songs, these old blues, I thought was terrific. And I guess a lot of people have said that revived him. But I remember a friend of mine got me an early copy of Time Out of Mind on cassette tape before it had been released. And I was walking around Montreal, listening to it on my Walkman, and it just captured me. And it's funny how certain albums, the first time you listen to them, they just draw you in, or they just don't move you at all.
So what was the first Dylan album you heard?
I have the clearest memory of being 8 years old and going to my next door neighbor and best friend Alan's house, and his older brother was playing something I had never heard anything like. It was I Want You. And, you know, just the repetitive organ and guitar riff, the chorus, it just stuck in my mind. It was like, it just grabbed me. And, you know, who is this guy? At that time, I was buying my first 45s and first Beatles albums. And, you know, he always kind of stuck in my mind. I didn't actually listen to any Dylan then. And it wasn't until I was in high school, I guess, or junior high, that I started exploring the older Dylan by that time, bringing it all back home and Highway 61 and eventually getting to the acoustic stuff. But it was right about that time that I was reading the Beats and Ken Kesey, and Dylan fit into that, pointing out the hypocrisies of American life. And, you know, even the president of the United States must have to stand naked, which in the Watergate era always drew this enormous roar from the crowd when he did it. And that's, you know, that's really where it began. And it was just kind of a on and off exploration until I was in college and started buying the albums sequentially as they came out.
And that would have been, I guess, that was mid-late 70s. You
know, that beginning, mid-70s. So beginning with Blood on the Tracks and Desire. Street Legal was never one of my favorites. The music was hard to listen to. And after I got over the shock of his Christian conversion, I really embraced those albums. And I was kind of, I felt like I was the, you know, the lone voice among my friends for sticking up for them. You know, I didn't really look at it as singing about Christ or the church. It just seemed more about pure love and devotion. And that spoke to me.
And rebirth, I guess.
And rebirth. And some of, a lot of those songs were funny also. When you're going to wake up, you know, God don't make promises he don't keep. I mean, I always cracked up when I heard him sing that. And in fact, during the 80s, somebody, I somehow got bootlegs of his recordings at Massey Hall doing those religious songs.
Yeah.
And those eventually came out just a few years ago as a bootleg, but they were magnificent. I mean, great band, great recordings, and committed singing. It was fantastic.
Yeah, that Toronto show, the one they released on that box set is phenomenal. It could stand as its own live album very, very easily.
Yeah. I mean, I started seeing Dylan concerts in the 80s, I guess, early 80s when he said he was at the bottom of his game. And I was still drawn in. Some of them were better than others, but when he was on, he was fantastic. There was always something that I was listening to and interested in. And, you know, it just got to the point where I was curious about what he was doing. I was reading all the books, but those mid-80s albums just were so disappointing. I never lost the thread, but I stopped automatically buying the albums. Mm.
But speaking of seeing him live and where you saw him live, I mean, I know you're from New York. You're New York born, born and bred, Manhattan, New York.
I was born outside of New York in Nassau County, the first ring of suburbs. But I've been living in Manhattan for 40 plus years now.
So is that where you've seen him most of the time live in New York?
Yeah, I've seen him pretty much every tour he's done through New York. And, you know, there have been assorted trips outside as well. My in-laws live in D.C., so I've gone down there to see shows with them. And my wife and I, my wife-to-be and I in 2001 were leaving town to get married right about the time he was coming to Manhattan. So we drove up to Syracuse to see him. And I also, in the 90s, I became friendly with Tony Garnier, who was working with Bob. You know, had been playing bass for him forever. So that was an added draw to see the band.
Played more shows with Bob Dylan than any musician ever, I think, by quite a long way.
I think so, by far.
Yeah, he's pretty cool. I mean, I just love watching him when I get a chance, you know, live or on you know, whatever, Masked and Anonymous, whenever he appears on camera, because he's so... Is he as cool as that in real life?
Absolutely. I met him back in the 90s. I was a restaurant critic at the Times, Mm-hmm. And I was occasionally moonlighting and doing like a profile of a musician who I was curious about. And I was writing about kind of an alt country guy, Junior Brown, who was a virtuoso of this instrument he had invented. He called it the Git Steel. That was a combination guitar and pedal steel. And I was on his tour bus talking to him, and the bus was parked outside of whatever the concert venue was. And Tony Garnier came on, and we were introduced, and he knew me through my restaurant writing, because he's really into food, and he's a great cook. I eventually wrote a story about him for the Times, because every year he used to cook a gumbo on Christmas, and he would invite a bunch of people over, or anybody was passing through who he knew. And this was an amazing gumbo. And so I got him to give me the recipe and wrote a story about him.
Oh, that's fantastic. I just feel a little bit close to him. He's such a great musician.
He can't have known back then that he was going to be playing with Dylan for nigh on 30 years, that it would be the rest of his, you know, his life, really, for so many, many years.
I mean, how could you know? How could you predict what Bob will do and which direction he'll go in? But, you know, he's very careful. He and I never spoken about Bob, except in the most general sorts of way, because that's not what he does. You know, I don't know if people have to sign NDAs or whatever. I'm sure they do, but
I'm sure there's something to do with anybody who plays with him for longer than a few days knows full well that the minute they start blabbing about him to other people, their days are presumably numbered.
Right.
I don't think it's in anyone's interest, is it?
Certainly in the last, say, 30 years. But of course, we had Rob Stoner on the podcast, and that was way before NDAs.
Yeah.
So
that's true.
mind.
Well, he also knows he's never playing with Bob again.
Well, exactly. Right. If you haven't had the call for, you know, the last 50 years, then probably that phone is not going to ring. Yeah.
Coincidentally, the night my story about Tony and his gumbo was published in the Times, they were playing in New York. And I went to see the concert, and Bob back then was in the phase, he would make a few jokes about each of the band members as he introduced them. And he introduced Tony, who he said really cooks on bass. So I felt that actually seen by Bob Dylan that night.
Yeah. Actually, I'm just going to get this over with. Because you were a food critic and you're currently New York Times wine critic, I just started going through the repertoire and looking for food references. And they're everywhere. Don't know if you've ever done that, but from, you know, just country pie, yeah, having a bottle of bread, Highland with the hard-boiled eggs, and Tweedledee and Tweedledum with the brains in the
pot. Brains in the pot.
Yeah, dripping with garlic and olive oil. But I mean, it just goes on and on. And then I was listening again to, I guess I was listening to, that's right, Modern Times, because I've always found Ain't Talkin', I've always liked it, but it's hard to concentrate, you know, on the long songs. So I was sitting there in my kitchen, actually. I was doing some cooking, and the line came up, Ain't Talkin', Just Walkin', eating hog-eyed grease in a hog-eyed town.
Yeah, I thought, what does that even mean?
Wow, yeah, what does that exactly? What does that even mean? It does sounds disgusting, doesn't it? I mean, completely hog-eyed grease. Not just grease. You're not just eating
hog-eyed
grease. Hog-eyed grease. But, you know, it's fine because it's a hog-eyed town, so it's got to be fresh, right?
Can you imagine playing in the band and hearing that lyric for the first time? I mean, you must crack up.
Well, it is. It's very – in fact, I cracked up. You know, you think Bob Dylan is not going to make you laugh, and not an old song that you've heard 100 times. But I actually cracked up. I thought, that's hilarious. It's so Bob. You don't know why it's funny.
Yeah, and you know, Bob actually was involved in a wine venture, I guess, in the mid-2000s. He had signed on with a really good winemaker in the Marche region of Italy, and they were issuing signed bottles with names like Planet Waves. And it was actually really good wine.
Was it?
So I had encountered his manager, Jeff Rosen, a few times back then and had gotten his contact info. And so I used to call Jeff about once a year trying to see if Bob was interested in talking about wine. And basically, I got some form of not a chance back from Jeff. But it seemed a good opportunity for me to try to get Bob.
If only he would ask about bourbon instead, you know. Maybe he would have.
Yeah, but I know the routine now. He's never going to talk about it.
But to talk about something else would be good, because I know that if I ever meet him, which I never will, I'll bring up boxing, because I know a fair amount about boxing, and I know that he does too. You know, and I would never talk to him about anything remotely close. So I would have thought that wine. Speaking of which, I did just my bit of research on that too. Of course, there's tons of wine references. I mean, not clearly businessmen, they drink my wine, and they railroad men just drink at your blood like wine.
Which isn't his line, I have to say. That's from the Harry Smith anthology of America.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah, well, he stole it. That's good. That's good.
Yeah. Or I started out on Burgundy.
Yes. Easily. I mean, it just goes on. What happened to that poison wine? You know, I gave it to you, drank it. And even if the wine don't come to the top of your cup from the Woody Guthrie poem. Right. But I mean, there's just tons and tons and tons. He does seem to be really into wine and drink. It's not wine and food, rather. It's not just, you know, a little coincidence. There was one point where I started researching this, and every second song had something about wine or food. It's, I guess he likes his wine and food.
You know, even in Chronicles, there are references to wine and food throughout. In his early songs, all the photos of him always at a bar or a coffee shop, bottle of red wine, cup of coffee there. I mean,
it's hard to imagine him drinking white wine somehow. Somehow he seems like a red wine guy to me.
That's true, and he'll need to be enlightened on that. And really, you know, right now it's hard to imagine him drinking wine at all. You know, the videos, because he's also very sales-minded. Now always show him drinking whiskey. Heaven's Door, of course.
Eric, very personal question, but are you religious at all? Because we've skirted around religion in that you know that you said you found the religious albums very interesting once you got past that development. Then we had Trying to Get to Heaven, and I was thinking about the wine thing, and of course there's biblical wine. Is that an area of...
No, I'm an atheist, and I come from a family of atheists and communists and... red labor lawyer. So not at all. I mean, I'm culturally a Jew and proud of that, but I'm not religious in the slightest.
No, I didn't think so. Just it interests me with the trying to get to heaven thing and then what you said
about
that.
I'm not bothered by it either.
Yeah.
And I find there's so much, I mean, you could devote hours to studying the Bible in Dylan songs or, you know, even today, the Christian imagery in them. You know, I decided it doesn't bother me whatever his religious predilections are. And clearly he is religious in some form or another. I'm not offended. You know, it's like, would you be, are you offended by all the religion in Beethoven or great classical music or, you know?
No. And I think it's really interesting because, of course, there is that very acutely religious period. But like you say, he didn't come out and say, that's all done now.
No,
he sort of gently incorporates into his shows. There are some of those songs that he still did. He still does Gotta Serve Somebody. But I remember in an interview a few years ago, someone asked him, are there any songs of yours that you think haven't had the right amount of attention that could be focused on a little bit more deserved attention? And he said, In the Garden.
Which I've always thought was a great song.
Yeah, and I that's fascinating to me that he thinks that about In the Garden.
He did that song for a long time, although he not for the last 10 or 15 years or so.
Speaking of doing songs, you're the only one. We haven't talked to anyone who's seen him live in the post-COVID times, but you saw him at the Beacon. So we don't usually ask too much about live stuff, but I'd like to ask this time. I mean, what did you take away from that?
He was great. It was a wonderful concert, and it was... I love Rough and Rowdy Ways. I mean, it's the first of his more recent albums since Love and Theft that I found myself being drawn to again and again and developing a really emotional tie to. Mm. And he did those songs so beautifully. I mean, I have to say his concerts have gotten better and better over the last 25 years. There was a time in the beginning of the century when he was playing, you know, really loud rock and roll style, which was fun. But in the last 10 years, he's really quieted the band down and created this sort of moody lounge stage set. And it's all become much more intimate. And I don't know if it was being off the road for a year or what, but his voice sounds better now than it's sounded in years.
I agree. And I think that lounge style would probably fit certain venues better than others. I mean, I've never been to the Beacon, but I've seen the Scorsese Rolling Stones film, which I think is at the Beacon, isn't it? Shine a Light.
Yes.
And I'm just imagining how perfect a venue that is for Dylan now. Whereas Hyde Park, for example, which is, I think, the last time he played in this country, not so much. But the Beacon, I'm sure, is perfect for him.
It's perfect for him now. I mean, one of the greatest Dylan concerts I saw was at Madison Square Garden in 2002, which is a big arena. I mean, he had a great band then with Charlie Sexton and Larry Campbell, and they could really carry it off. And that was his period of doing cover versions of people like Warren Zevon and the Rolling Stones. And those were great fun. And that night he did, because they were in London, I guess they were doing the tribute to George Harrison and he couldn't be there.
That's right.
So he did something that night, which was just tremendous. But yeah, the concert was, not only was it great and not only was he enunciating every word, but I think for the first time I had the kind of a revelatory feeling during the concert. His song from Rough and Rowdy Ways, I decided to devote myself to you.
Give myself.
Yeah, which, you know, you listen to it on the album and I thought at first it's a pleasant song, but in concert, he gets up from behind the piano with his microphone and he sings it to the audience. And it just took on an entirely different meaning, as if, you know, it was this this act of generosity that, you know, he was going to spend his life singing his songs, not for his own benefit, but for the benefit of the audience.
Isn't that beautiful? Because I've heard some people say, I've made up my mind to give myself to you is to God, but actually to his audience is a rather lovely sentiment, isn't it? After all this time, I've made up my mind. I'm going to do this for you, actually, audience.
Yeah, it was so interesting because he's considered uninterested in the audience. And, you know, people complain that he doesn't talk. I don't care about that. They complain he changes the songs. I think that's great. But, you know, the common perception of him is somebody sort of odd and misanthropic and simply uninterested in entertainment and uncaring about how he's received. And I feel underneath it's not at all true. It's just that his devotion to his art takes precedence over his devotion to entertainment. And in some way, they can be combined if you're open to receiving it that way.
He was quite jocular towards the crowd at one of those Beacon shows. I'm not sure which one you went to.
Not the one I was at. In fact, you know, he made a geographical remark as he had been doing, locating himself, you know, talking about the various landmarks. But then he forgot to introduce the band.
What do you mean completely?
Just forgot completely, which was disappointing to me because he did it at every other show. I remember there was a time when he used to introduce the band members, each with like his own dad joke. And they were the lamest one-liners, you know, and somebody made a collection of those. You can find a link on Expecting Rain, and they're just so funny.
Well, the first time I saw him with Tony Garnier, I think, was in 1993, and he he made a huge joke and talked to the audience and totally exposed Tony Garnier with a bass solo that he wasn't ready for. And then just watched it fall apart in front of his eyes and then just mumbled, maybe I'll get rid of him. You know, this was 1993. He's played a few gigs with him since then, but he took real joy in doing that.
That's funny. And unfortunately, that was a one-off. I'd love to hear Tony play a bass solo.
Oh, I've got a bootleg. I'll send it to you. It's very, very funny.
Right.
But it is, something's happened, it seems to me, during the lockdown period where he came back and he had his voice back in a lot of ways. And but more importantly, this this communication with the audience, this stepping out front and singing to the audience. I mean, he was doing that through the
Sinatra concerts.
We went to one of those Sinatra concerts. He'd go to the mic, but I always got the feeling he was like beating us over the head with it. I mean, I just got the feeling that he was challenging us, I didn't get the feeling he was giving himself to us. I got the feeling he was forcing himself down our throats. That's the feeling I got.
Well, I enjoyed that concert, and I didn't have the feeling of that he was giving either, but he was doing that lounge singer kind of thing where he would just step out with the microphone. You could imagine him doing that in the shower like Bill Murray.
But again, I think that's the venue.
It was meaningful in this recent concert because, you know, there were times when he didn't look steady on his feet. You know, he's 80 years old. You're at the point where, like, every step you're just hoping that he's not going to fall.
But, there's a thing online where somebody's whooping or heckling or something, and this was before COVID. It's easily found. I can't remember what the song was, but he remonstrates with the person. He says, you know, cut it out or something. And he steps back and he trips over a cable.
Right.
And he almost falls over. He takes about four or five steps back, almost. Yeah. He looks like he's going to, you know, have a really terrible accident and manages to steady himself. And that was, I guess, about 4 or 5 years ago. So, yeah, ever since I saw that, I thought, boy, you guys have got to, you know, get those cables laid down properly. You don't want
It's that boxing training. It's good for footwork.
It is. Yes. I must say he did cover very well. It is that boxing training that probably saved him. I mean, presumably the atmosphere was just crazy at the Beacon.
Well, you know, it was a younger crowd than I'm used to at Bob shows. Mm. You know, usually it's a bunch of people with prostate problems. and this, you know, this show had had a younger crowd. It also had the, various well-known Dylan fans there. It was just really cool. It was relief as well. You know, just that was that very slim interval when I saw him between Delta and Omicron. And, you know, you just felt like maybe we're out of it now. It was just great.
And it must have been like a Dylan lyric. Sorry, between Delta and Omicron. Or it sounds like it was between Delta and Omicron. Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to note that when you saw him in New York, it was within the week of being 60 years to the day that he started recording his first album in New York as well. And I'm sure that went completely unremarked upon.
Yes, totally. And, it's amazing when you start measuring time. Like I was just thinking about Time Out of Mind, which I, you know, said, I want to take something from his later stuff. But that's 25 years old now.
Yeah.
It's like the time between his first album and, Almost No Mercy.
Yeah, I mean, if that's 60 years ago, you know, 60 years before that was the Boer War, you know, it's ridiculous.
Right.
How long? When you think the Beatles had 7 years, he had 60.
Yeah. And, you know, when you go see a concert like that, I'm also always struck by how I can't think of any other artist, certainly in pop music, but really in any field, who's had that span of creativity. You know, you go see an 80-year-old guy doing his new songs. Mm. I mean, it's unheard of. The Stones are playing their 50-year-old songs, and that's what people want to hear.
Yeah, there is no real comparison. I mean, even Leonard Cohen has been gone now for over 5 years, and he started a good 5 years after Dylan. You know, there aren't many comparisons who've had that kind of staying power.
Yeah, Neil Young, maybe? I don't know.
Maybe Neil Young, yeah.
But has Neil Young done his best album when he's 79.
I don't know. I hear Barn is good. Yet. I don't know. I haven't heard Barn.
What about, speaking of times, we exchanged an email a few weeks ago, Eric, and you talked about you prefer Love and Theft to say Modern Times. And I'm just trying to stir it up here because I know Modern Times is one of Luke's favorite later albums. I tend to agree with you, but yeah, do you want to speak to that?
I said before, there are always songs that you want to skip, and there are just more of them on Modern Times for me. Mm. There's a few great songs on that album, Working Man Blues and Nettie Moore and Ain't Talking, but there, you know, I think Dylan got into a rut somewhere where he started doing bar band blues musical tracks that just go on forever. Mm. And they're repetitive, and I find them uninteresting. That was true on Love and Theft as well, with Honest With Me and Lonesome Day Blues. That I, those are the songs I skip on that album, right. Although they had a revival in concert. But the atmospherics of that album, the musicianship, you know, I think they really capture the Larry Campbell, Charlie Sexton band at its peak.
Love and Theft.
Humor on that album, Love and Theft. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, Love and Theft kind of sets a template, doesn't it, for at least 20 years. Whereas Time Out of Mind is not like that, and I think the template that's set by Love and Theft is very much continued through Modern Times and then together through Life.
That's true. He started producing himself and using his road band.
And I think it depends on your tolerance for kind of Muddy Waters-esque riffs and things like that before you do go, okay.
I think on Modern Times he does overdo the – it's nothing but sort of – the blues is kind of sludgy. I don't know how to put it. But for some reason, Modern Times doesn't interest me that much musically anyway, because Love and Theft does. Love and Theft perks me up every time I put it on.
And even if some of those – songs are derivative. Mm. You know, I guess he took Tweedledee from some 50s song or even older.
And, Uncle John's Bongos.
Yeah, yeah, it's a complete.
Thank you.
Yeah, he took it completely. But it's exciting.
And Sugar Baby as well. Yes, it's exciting, and the musicianship is great. The words are funny. And, you know, there's such a different feel to that album because he's going back to kind of old 30s parlor music, I guess, with Floater, By and By, Moonlight, and even the blues-esque Cry for Me. I mean, that's a funny song with tempo changes. That's just, it's not as musically repetitive as some of the other Muddy Waters-esque songs.
I think it was a Grammy performance of Cry a While he did, I guess, the year after, that I think Bonnie Raitt said is the funkiest performance by a white man that's ever been given or something. It's really good. It's really, really good.
What was the song he was doing? Was it at the Grammys where the soy bomb guy came?
That was Love Sick.
Yeah. That was Love Sick. That was pretty much agreed that was a setup, right? That
he was a performance artist, yeah.
He knew he was going to come on.
Rolling Thunder Review is, I think.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing that we haven't talked about that goes along with this later period is both Chronicles and his radio show. And there have also been other speeches that he's given. There was a time in the 80s or 90s when if you saw Bob talk, it tended to be incoherent, guarded, weird. You know, it's just like, what the fuck is he talking about? Yeah. And then, you know, he started becoming relatable in a way, especially on the radio show. And I loved his radio shows.
Me too.
I thought they just showed great musical taste, were fun to listen to, informational, informal, kind in a way.
Yeah.
It changed things for me. I think a lot of perceptions are stuck in the 80s, 90s.
I hope we have some more. I mean, I'm not sure. I'm sure he doesn't plan these things, but we had 100 and then a couple surfaced and then there was a special one, a year ago or so. I'd be really happy to have some more Theme Time Radio Hour. I really would.
There are a couple of bootleg Theme Timers that I haven't been able to track down. And I have to recall what the subjects were.
There's Kiss, out there somewhere. Which is one of I've got them all somewhere. And there's the whiskey one.
Yeah. The whiskey one, right. That was very promotional, which I get.
But he did sound like, I mean, it was very clearly, blatantly flogging the old Bob Dylan whiskey, but it was one of the most fun ones because he sounded like 10 years younger.
Yeah.
You know, towards isn't that, the end,
when he said, it wasn't that the one where he said, because in the early shows, he was talking about listening on your record player or your CD player. And he said, nowadays, you might even be listening on your smart toaster.
That's right.
right.
I mean, he was just loving them. He used to sort of sneak those dad jokes underneath. And then he was like a stand up in the last one. Like, I'm sure we all, if we had some request for Bob, it'd be bring back Theme Time Radio.
Sometimes I'm listening to music in my car and I hear a song and I think, oh, that song's about a fairground. I could think about five songs about fairgrounds. And I think, why doesn't Bob Dylan do a song, a Theme Time Radio Hour about fairgrounds or something like that? There's so many things he could do.
He's too busy. I mean, we've discussed Shadow Kingdom quite a lot on this, but I think it's so great the way he that's typical of his sort of reinvention of songs. And I was reading an article actually about it the other day, and I noticed that, I mean, it was quite clear that he changed the names of songs. So It's All Over Now, Baby Blue, which would easily have fit on screen. He just called Baby Blue. So not only did he change lots of the lyrics, but he just decided to change the titles as well. And that's the sort of thing I'm sure we all love about him, you know, that moving forward.
I love the moving forward, although sometimes I find it alarming. I was looking through the lyrics book, looking for inspiration, and I turned to Blood on the Tracks. I saw it Tangled Up in Blue, and those are the original lyrics, even though he's changed them in concert many times. Then I looked at the lyrics of If You See Her, Say Hello, and they're completely butchered. And, you know, he's cut out verses and changed rhymes. And I mean, it's not for me to say what he can do with his songs. And as I said, I'm very hesitant to advise him or, you know, be like Clinton Halen and tell him he's doing it all wrong. But I just was appalled by what he did. And if you look at the lyrics in his book, they're, you know, it's bizarre. It's not an improvement. I had to go back to the song to really feel better about it.
Yeah, it is. His reasoning is often escapes us mortals. I was listening to the Shadow Kingdom bootleg of the music the other day, and I was listening to Paint My Masterpiece. And again, he said, "Gonna wash my clothes, scrape off all of the grease. I'll stay right there until I paint my masterpiece."
Hog-eyed grease.
And it was more grease. Again, I thought, there's a theme merging here, but what is the? But of course, there was the pretty little girl from Grease in the, I guess it was the original one that was released.
Two different kinds of grease, though. Yeah.
Exactly. He's changed grease to grease. Do you think it's an homage to the musical Grease? I mean, who knows? What the hell's going on?
I doubt that.
I mean, even in Trying to Get to Heaven, he shifted a line in the written lyrics. When you think that you've lost everything, you find out you can always lose a little more. He put it in a different place in the written lyrics. And, you know, I've listened to some recordings since then, and he sings it the way it was originally recorded. So I'm just not sure what the reasoning there was, or is it, you know, are these transcription errors or what?
That's a fascinating line too, because that's a riff on When You Ain't Got Nothing, You Got Nothing to Lose, isn't it?
Right, right.
Is there a song of Dylan's that continues to mystify you, or that you think is, you know, impenetrable?
Well, I mean, so many of them seem impenetrable.
Yeah, okay.
To me.
Well, a particular, like for instance, you were talking about Working Man's Blues being one of your the songs that you think you like on Modern Times. Whereas I've actually, it's not that I think it's mysterious, because I think it's a bit on the nose. But for me, let's say I'll rephrase my question. I would say I think that's one of his more musically dull songs. To me, I don't like Working Man's Blues. That's one of the ones that I just moved.
You know, I think I've seen him do that in concert quite a few times, and it's heightened my affection. I don't actually, I almost never listen to that album, Modern Times. Mm-hmm. You know, if I missed, okay, there are songs that do mystify me, and you know, I love the song Joker Man, for example. Mm. But I have no idea what it's talking about.
It's about Greece, obviously, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of his 80s material that people try to find, you know, some redeeming benefit in, whether it's, you know, new Danville Girl or When the Night Comes Falling from the Sky. I just, you know, I listened to them once just to refresh my memory, and it reminds me why I don't really listen to Dylan from that period.
Yeah, I'm a bit like that with most of Street Legal, in that I think some lines jump out and are absolutely brilliant, but the actual songs, most of them, are so mystifying.
I would also say No Mercy, which is an album that I recognize its meaning, but I don't like it musically. It's just too stop and start. In a song like Man in the Long Black Coat, I just don't get it.
You know, it doesn't. Because that to me, that's a story song. It's not a strong story, but I can kind of picture it. It's very visual to me.
Yeah, me too. You know, it seems I kind of think that Dylan's best work from the late 80s was for the Wilburys.
You know, yeah, no, I'm with you. I love
that. I mean, there he just seemed liberated, and he didn't have to be heavy. He could just be funny and open. And you see, he still had his sense of humor and a sense of observation.
There is a theory, and Stephen Cockcroft, who does the Nothing Is Real podcast, they did an episode on the Wilburys, and he and I have known each other for a while. And he was saying the more he researched that period, he started to think that the whole point of the Traveling Wilburys was George Harrison trying to help Bob Dylan get out of his rut. And if you look at it, it worked, because after that, you know, he had a greater sense of freedom. He felt more confident about what he was doing. And it looks more and more like just a really lovely gesture from a friend to say, come on, let's go play with some friends in the garage, and you can rediscover what you like about playing music. And I think maybe he's got a point.
I think there's a lot to it. And it's not as if the music Bob started recording on his own then had that sense of lightness and freedom. I mean, No Mercy is a dark album.
Oh, Mercy is my, what I've said before, but it's one of my absolute favorites. I adore it.
Yes. I know you've said that, and I've gone back to it exactly for that reason, because if Luke loved it, there's something to it, and I'm just missing.
But it's funny, isn't it? I think there's something about one's individual personality that is manifested in one's favorite Bob Dylan album. You know, there's something about Luke that is very Oh Mercy.
Grumpy man in his late 40s. Yeah, no, I hear.
No, you know, and I like Love and Theft probably because of the humor. I'm sort of drawn to that. It speaks to me. And not that I don't like Oh Mercy, because I do. But it's the reason I don't like Modern Times so much, because it doesn't...
It doesn't have the humor of Love and Theft. Right. Love and Theft is just full of jokes.
I'm clearly the problem here, because I love Modern Times and I love Oh Mercy, and maybe I just turn my back on the joy. That's what it is.
No, but it's, you know, it does speak to our own personalities, and there's nothing wrong with our personalities.
Right. Yeah. I also feel Oh Mercy is just, it's trapped in that Daniel Lanois morass again. You know, it's everything is like thick and oozy and stop and start and... You know, swampy, I guess, is the word that's often used to describe his layering production techniques. But it just is so, it's almost claustrophobic for me, and not in a good way.
Yeah, I think that's what Bob kind of felt too. I mean, he certainly wrote about that in Chronicles. I think he felt sort of bogged down, but on the other hand, he also felt, I think, weirdly stimulated, because... Although he's dispensed with producers, he did seem to...
He did call Lanois again.
Yeah, you know, so, I mean, who knows what goes on in that wonderful head of his. Is there any other song or album from the... Mike, what is that sound?
There's a New York City sound.
You hear New York...
That's fantastic.
I thought he was out on the avenue.
It sounds like a bunch of wolves howling to me through the through my mic.
Yeah, I live not too far from a hospital, and you know that was the sound of the early pandemic sirens going by.
God,
the wind began to howl.
Yeah.
I was just going to ask, because we haven't, this is very unusual for us because we've concentrated mostly on the later albums, but are there any other fave early ones?
Yeah. I mean, I just love Bringing It All Back Home. That's strangely my favorite of that trio of albums. And of course, Freewheelin' is wonderful. John Wesley Harding, I love. You know, of course, I understand. I mean, I love Blonde on Blonde. The music sometimes, is, as with John Wesley Harding, seems a little screechy to me. That Wild Mercury sound. But the songs always are giving you something new every time you go back to them.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think, you know, my all-time favorite songs is It's All Right, Ma. I just think there's so much in that song, and there's so much there that, and I keep going back to it through the ages. When I tried to get my kids, when they were teenagers, into Bob, that's what I played. And I'm not sure it took, but... You know, Bob is somebody they laugh about as dad's music.
Isn't there a scene in either the last or the penultimate episode of The Sopranos where AJ's listening to It's All Right, Ma?
Yeah, it's towards the end, and he's necking with his girlfriend in the SUV, and then the SUV blows up, basically.
And doesn't he say something like, this guy's writing like it could be like now, or something?
Yeah.
Doesn't he?
Yeah. And then the CD melts. You remember, because he sort of goes, "It's all right, Ma." I have no idea what that was. You know, there was a reason that they were listening to Bob Dylan, but I don't quite get it. But it was lovely to see the cultural icon that was AJ listening to BD.
Well, I'm rewatching The Sopranos with my son, which is taking years because he doesn't even live here anymore. But when we get to that episode, I'm hoping he'll hear that song and the clouds will part and he'll go, "Yes, I see. I see, Dad."
The Sopranos is fun just for the musical choices there.
Yeah.
What about Bob's contribution, the old Dean Martin song? What was it? Return to Me.
Return to Me.
Yeah. Return to Me. You know, he does a lovely massacre.
I don't even remember that.
Yeah, no, it's on the soundtrack of the first Sopranos soundtrack,
you know,
CD.
My thought when his Sinatra album came out was that I wish he'd done Dean Martin rather than Frank Sinatra.
Well,
I love Frank, but I always thought Dean was more louche and sort of dissolute and the real guy who wouldn't knuckle under.
He says in I think it's the first Theme Time Radio Hour, I think he plays Dean Martin's version of I Don't Care If the Sun Don't Shine, which of course Elvis Presley made very famous, and he said, "Let's just not forget Elvis wanted to be Dean Martin."
Right.
That was great.
Oh, that's interesting. No, I didn't know that. But of course, that brings us back to the wine in a way, you know, because Dean Martin pretended to be drunk.
I think he was drinking vodka or scotch or whatever, whatever they would give him. You know, I have one bottle left of Planet Waves, Bob's wine from 2005 or whenever. If you ever make it to New York, let me know.
Hey, listen, I would love that, and I don't even drink.
It's a date.
Which is better, the album or the wine?
I think the wine aged better than the album.
Is It Rolling, Bob? Talking Dylan is recorded on Zencaster.
Engineered by Mark Langley Smith and produced by Robin Guise. Digital imaging by Finn Guise. Music is by Sam Hare.
We're part of Pantheon Podcasts, the music podcast network.
Find us on Twitter at IsItRollingPod.
Wintertime in New York Town. The wind blowing the snow around. Walk around with nowhere to go. Somebody could freeze right to the bone. I froze right to the bone. New York Times said it was the coldest winter in 17 years. I didn't feel so cold then.